BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
We humans are resourceful, adaptable, and the smartest thing this planet has ever seen. We got ourselves into this climate mess with tree felling, gas guzzling, and steel forging. But we can get out of it. There are so many solutions to climate change, some proven and growing, others possible yet craving uptake. And in 39 ways to save the planet, we'll chart the route to a cooler world without breaking the bank or sending us back to the Stone Age. The ocean is a great friend to us in the fight against climate change. Since the Industrial Revolution, it's absorbed something like one-third of the carbon dioxide mankind has emitted. And with a bit of a helping hand, it can absorb even more. Today we're at the coast to see how the plants of the sea are an amazing carbon storage project.
This is an extraordinary sight. I am in effect flying across a meadow, and as I look down, I can see fronds swaying in the current. And I'm in the midst of a seagrass bed. The fronds are about 30 to 40 centimetres long, some kind of really bright, almost lime green, others a bit more brown. Mixed in with them a few floating bits of seaweed. I'm just going to put my mask on again and see what else I can see in more detail. It's a little bit murky today because the wind's blowing some of the sediment into the bay. But it's reckoned that this habitat, this stuff, seagrass, is one of the potential hidden weapons in our fight against climate change because of its ability to absorb so much carbon. I'm not on my own here. I should say here is off the Llyn Peninsula in northwest Wales. I'm in about a metre or so of water. I'm with some guys from Project Seagrass, particularly Richard Lilly, known to his mates as RJ. Tell me, first of all, what you've got in your hands there.
Well, so this is just some seagrass. What you're looking at is a plant which is flowering, and if you can make out just these very, very delicate protrusions really from the blade, these are seagrass flowers. So they don't
look like little hairs.
They're essentially like little hairs, absolutely. And so that's how a blade will be pollinated. And then if you look into these other two, what we call spathes, if you look very carefully, that sort of lime green colour, these are the very early seeds. So these are the seeds that will eventually grow and become more mature and then eventually harden and drop out to grow and become plants of their own.
But you've already said some things which I find quite surprising. You've talked about seeds, flowers, pollination, things I associate with the land and the meadows, not with the water.
Well, and do you know what? This is relatively new to science. I mean, I think a paper was published maybe just 5 or 6 years ago.
Really?
Detailing this. You know, we had suspicions about how this might work. I think it was a team from the States have actually evidenced this. So, yeah, phenomenal, really.
I don't know whether we should go over and join your colleagues here, but what are you actually doing here?
In this part of Wales, we've actually got Wales' largest seagrass meadow. However, there are areas within the bay and within the meadow which have been damaged. So today, we're actually just repairing some of those damaged areas and planting these little hessian bags full of seeds.
Seagrass is really good at absorbing carbon dioxide, but over the years, it's taken quite a battering, particularly around the coast of Britain. The team from Swansea and Cardiff universities are developing ways in which they can help existing seagrass beds to recover and spread. They're also returning seagrass in places where it died off years, decades, maybe even centuries ago. They're basically greening up the seafloor.
So, Rich, where would you like me to do a line out just behind you here? Or
Bethan's done a line behind you where I'm at. There's a line to those rocks in kelp over there. So just a metre or two behind me.
OK, magic. No worries.
As I snorkel over to Richard Unsworth, he's in the middle of a rather tricky manoeuvre.
You said you couldn't move because you've got something between your legs. What have you got between your legs?
On my right knee is the last bag that I've planted, and I'm trying to then plant another bag where my left knee is.
Okay.
So I'm doing that all the way along, shuffling along and knee's width. a part of planting these little hessian bags into the sediment using a little wooden stake. Okay. And all this stuff will rot away, and the little plant will pop up and embed its roots and hopefully grow. So
you're very much planting by hand, and it's almost like a spread knees width apart, is it? That gives you a kind of...
It's all very low-tech planting, but that's part of the process of trying to work out how the hell we can do this so that we can expand it and turn it into a much bigger operation. Around the world, there's about 80 species of seagrass. In the UK, we've got two species that live in a completely marine environment. So we've got a third one that lives in the sort of lagoon and estuaries. Seagrasses aren't an incredibly biodiverse plant group, but it's the habitat that they create that supports biodiversity and provides incredible sort of functions to our coastal environment.
I've heard that they're an incredibly effective carbon sink and have an ability to absorb carbon dioxide more rapidly than a rainforest. Was there actually a figure about how many times more quickly than a rainforest they can do?
There's many different types of seagrass meadows around the world, or seagrass species, and some are much more effective at sequestering carbon than others. The figure that's often quoted is 35 times more effective than a rainforest, which is an outstanding figure. That's not all seagrasses. Seagrasses come in different shapes and sizes. Some are small, maybe 2 inches tall, rich in carbohydrates. It's the food for dugongs and sea turtles. And others are much, much taller. The species that we have in the Mediterranean is like the oak tree of the seagrasses.
But I mean, 35 times is a stunning figure. Even if you're only 5 times or 2 times, that's still pretty impressive in terms of power of carbon sequestration, isn't it?
Absolutely phenomenal. The concern is the rate at which we're losing these seagrass meadows.
And RJ, what does it mean to you to be involved in a project like this?
I love it. Grabbing a big idea and looking to see just what we can achieve is what I want to be doing with my day to day. The climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis worry me. I'm a new father. If I can do my bit over the next 10, 20, 30 years, then I'll do that.
Richard, how is it they can be such effective carbon sinks?
So seagrasses are incredibly productive. Their leaf turnover rate is very, very high. That means throughout the season, many of those leaves break off, and many of them actually stay in that seagrass meadow. They get caught in the leaf material. They sink to the sediment where actually they don't rot away. A lot of that carbon gets locked in the sediments and can be stored over time.
So that element of it is a little bit like the forest, that leaves fall off, branches fall off, and they go to the forest floor. But you're saying they don't rot in quite the same way, so more of the carbon is actually stored than would be on a forest leaf litter.
Seagrasses also have this incredible particle trapping ability, because as water moves over a seagrass meadow, it increases the friction, and that slows the water down. And particles in that water will actually drop out and sink and become trapped in that complex seagrass sediment that then doesn't actually rot away. So bits of carbon from fish poo to seagull excrement, anything, any bits of organic matter that are floating around in that water column.
One of the things I find fascinating is you can actually see, like even if you didn't know too much about the science behind carbon sequestration, in the Mediterranean again, you can get these huge rhizome mats, we call them, but it's basically the root system which is built up over many, many years. You can literally dive down the face of these rhizome mats and you can visualise just how much carbon has been locked in there over the years.
That sounds very much like a peat section that you might get on land where you
very
can
similar,
see it
very similar
from plant to almost coal at the bottom.
Yeah, much the same, and you're literally looking back in time as you go deeper.
So what is the potential for seagrass restoration? Let's start with the UK. Where could it go?
Aspirationally, we'd like to try and emulate, I guess, some of the work that's been done in the USA. It's the same species. Over the past 20 years, they've done over 30 kilometres squared of seagrass meadows in Chesapeake Bay. It's a very different ecosystem to what we've got here. We've got a lot larger tidal range, and so we can't just throw the seeds over the side of the boat or they'll end up in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And so we've had to develop a custom bespoke method for restoring here.
And you have two field sites, one here on the Clain Peninsula in kind of northwest Wales, and the other one?
The other site that we've been working at is in Dale in Milford Haven Waterway in Pembrokeshire. And that's where we've created the UK's first major seagrass restoration project.
Essentially what we've done is we've taken these little hessian bags and we fill them with inert sand, so sand which hasn't got any microbes in it, and then we put 50 seeds in each of these bags. And we'll tie these bags at roughly 1 meter intervals along some biodegradable sisal rope, and we'll slowly lower those off a rib in basically lines along the seafloor. So from that method, in about 3 or 4 weeks' time, we'll have planted 1 million seeds in South Wales.
You haven't been doing it very long. Have you any idea if they're taking root yet?
We have.
You're seeing the green shoots of recovery.
We are seeing the green shoots, the seeds of hope. Yeah, so the seeds went in just before COVID. There was some fantastic weather, nice stable conditions. And so once we were able to get out and check on the seedlings in the summer, we were pleased with the results. We've got some great photos of these shoots climbing towards the surface. So, yep, very pleased with what we've achieved so far.
Your little babies are doing well.
They are indeed. Proud.
Proud fathers, the pair of you. Where is the seabed right for doing this in the UK if we really wanted to be ambitious?
Seagrasses have been lost around the UK for many hundreds of years. And I guess our coastlines have changed since then. And there are now opportunities where those environments are now suitable for seagrass to live again. But there's not enough seagrass to supply seed to naturally enable recovery to happen. But there's lots of gaps in our coastline where there is no longer seagrass. So places like the Humber, the Stour, the Orwell, the Forth, coastlines around North Wales that were decimated by heavy metal mining. There's a lot of historic sort of industrial past of the UK that's now presenting an opportunity for environmental renewal.
Well, listening to that with me is Dr. Tamsin Edwards, climate expert from King's College London. Well, as you can tell, it felt pretty good to plant my little mouse-sized packet of seagrass seeds. Have I done a lot to save the world?
Well, seagrass is a really important ecosystem in the UK. It's really important for not just marine life, but things like birds and invertebrates. In the Thames estuary, we have the sea aster mining bee. You can go and see the eelgrass on the tidal flats and the salt marshes there. When I was on a geography field trip with our students recently, we were in the Thames estuary and the big tidal mud flats have this seagrass. And if you disturb the surface of the mud with your boot, you can see all this black carbon underneath, doing just as we've said, storing that carbon up for the future. Around the world, we think we've got about 16 million hectares of seagrass, maybe up to 27, but we've lost around 6 million hectares. And if we can restore that and protect it from being lost, we can store some carbon. It's not going to be really big on the global scale, but it has all those other benefits for the local ecosystems.
So when you say not big, we're talking sort of less than 0.1% or something, are we?
Exactly. But seagrass isn't the only type of what we call blue carbon. The marine, the coastal ecosystems that store carbon, there's also salt marshes and mangroves. And if you add all of those up together and protect and restore those, we can get to 0.1 or 0.2% of our global greenhouse gas emissions.
It is, as you say, a solution with so many collateral benefits, isn't it? Fish nurseries, the beauty, the recreation. And I looked at where they've re-established a lot on the east coast of the United States, and it's had an extraordinary restorative effect, even on the commercial fishing there.
Absolutely, and people are really starting to see the potential here. There are some uncertainties in how to seed these ecosystems quickly, how long they take to kind of ramp up, and we've got to protect them from pollution and from disturbances as well in the future.
You mentioned these other blue carbon solutions, mangroves, coastal wetlands. Are there projects around the world to restore and enlarge those as well?
Absolutely. Mangroves are such a critical ecosystem, for example, around the world, preventing coastal erosion, helping with people's livelihoods. They're really something we're looking at restoring for the future.
One of the big, as they call it, nature-based solutions to climate change.
Absolutely. And blue carbon is one of those things we've only just really started to understand quite how important it is.
Thanks very much, Tamsin, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode of 39 Ways to Save the Planet. In our next episode, how educating more girls could help save the world.
I'm holding on to one of these crickets, but they are jumpers. I managed to get hold of one, but it escaped again.